This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with James Windham, executive director of a group involved with getting people on their feet after time in prison. The group is called the Capital Area Reentry Coalition, and there will be a forum tonight at LSU regarding crime in our community, and James Windham will be part of that, and we'll visit with him first thing this morning. Also on the show, John McMillan, his book is Beatles versus Stones, the friendship and rivalry of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and C.B. Fergonston on the changing the guard in the 5th Congressional District is Vance McAllister, an outsider supported by the Duck Dynasty crowd, defeated Neil Reiser, an insider supported by the Jindal political machine. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local dial. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Kevin Gallagher producing, and we begin with James Windham. He is executive director of the Capital Area Reentry Coalition. Tonight, Mr. Windham will be as part of a forum at LSU at the Journalism Building, the Holiday Forum, at 7 p.m., and others include Dr. Ed Shahada, the sociology professor, Dr. Cecile Guin, the director of social services research and development at LSU, Dr. Peter Scharf, a criminologist from Tulane, Representative Alfred Williams, David Cressy, state coordinator of the Louisiana Reentry Advisory Council, will be on hand as well. Good morning to you, James Windham.
Good morning. Thanks, Jim, for having me on the show this morning.
Well, tell us about the genesis of Capital Area Reentry Coalition.
Well, several years ago, a group of people got together and they wanted to make a difference when it comes to reentry, and they brought a lot of people together. And because they recognized that no one person can make a huge imprint in this arena, and so after several years of talking and blending their resources together, in 2011 we decided to become a nonprofit tax exempt corporation. Our coalition consists of over 75 different partners, both governmental, faith-based, as well as nonprofit, and all of these are entities are all geared toward making sure that we provide every resource, every tool necessary, that the returning citizen coming back to our neighborhoods have everything they need to have a successful reentry. And when that happens, our communities remain safe.
Well, your organization reintegrates citizens returning from prison back into society. How many people have you worked with in the last few years?
In the last few years, we've interacted with over 250 different male and female coming out of the state facilities as well as your local jail. The wonderful thing about our program is that we've incorporated a mentoring component as well, and that begins while the person is still incarcerated. We've recognized the stats have shown that the earlier we are able to integrate and interact with these individuals, the more likely they will be successful once they reenter.
What are the biggest challenges for people who have served time and are trying to get back on their feet?
Oh, various, many, many challenges. One, housing, transportation, but more importantly, jobs. Employment is a big, big issue. One of the things that we're really working on right now, and it's a national movement, actually, is ban the box. We need employers to recognize that if we can get the men and women coming out of incarceration good, livable wage jobs, mm-hmm. the likelihood of them returning to prison is less likely. But one of the hindrances is that box on the application that indicates that says that if you've ever been convicted or arrested. And once we can eliminate that box, what that does is it opens the door for that individual to get an interview based on the merit of that application. And so jobs is a real, real big issue.
Well, shouldn't an employer know if he or she is interviewing a person who has served time?
They should know that. what we're asking for is the opportunity for that individual to get into the door based on the merit of that application. Once that interview occurs, that employer has full right to do a background check, to ask questions regarding that individual. But once again, the likelihood is this. Because of the tremendous work of Secretary LeBlanc at getting different programs available for individuals who are incarcerated, such as getting skills such as welding and carpentry and things of that nature, these individuals are coming not only motivated to work but skilled to work. They need just an opportunity. So if a guy is sitting in front of an interviewer and he has skills in carpentry or millwright or whatever, the likelihood is that that interviewer is going to hire this person based on the skills and the aptitude of that individual. And that's what we want.
We're visiting with James Windham. We'll have him for a few more minutes, the executive director of a group called Capital Area Reentry Coalition. Tonight he's part of a forum at LSU's Journalism School at 7 o'clock called Seize the Crime, Reduce Recidivism. James Windham, as far as white-collar positions, is it very hard for a convicted criminal, somebody who's been an inmate, to get out of jail and to get a job of that kind?
It is unfortunate, but it doesn't cross economic lines. Once you have been convicted, unfortunately, we still live in a society that my interaction based on the crime that you committed yesterday. And it's unfortunate, but we need to change the language from them and change it into us, because if it's always about them, regardless of whether it's blue collar or white collar, they're always always going to be left holding the bag, so to speak. We need to change the language to it's about us, because the more we frame that language to be about us, then our city will flourish, because we'll give everyone an opportunity to do to have the life that God intended.
Well, Louisiana right now reportedly has more construction jobs available than there are people to fill them.
Absolutely.
So is there any kind of training that goes on when these people are behind bars?
Absolutely. As I indicated earlier, Secretary LeBlanc has many, many programs available in the prisons, LCIW, Dixon, Hunt, where they're training guys and women for all sorts of jobs, culinary, welding, carpentry, automotives, everything that an individual would have a great life once they're released. In fact, right now, the Capital Area Reentry Coalition has been awarded a Department of Labor grant where we're going to be able to have guys training on heating and air. A huge, huge market is out there just for that type of training. So there are lots of training. What we need to make sure is that there are lots of employers willing to hire those guys who are trained.
I remember several years ago there was a lawmaker who had a bill that would have prevented inmates from lifting weights while they were in jail. That seems to make no sense. You want these people in shape so that they're employable when they get out of jail. What would being in shape have to do with something other than lawmakers perhaps being a little jealous?
Well, as Secretary LeBlanc has indicated several times, we need to be smart on crime, not, you know, continue to do the same things that we've done in the past, which has not actually been effective. For instance, if an individual sent their child to 4 years of college and spent, you know, $200,000 for that child to get an education, we would be appalled if that child came back after 4 years not having been any smarter after 4 years than they were when they went in. And we as a state need to look at how we conduct ourselves when it comes to incarceration. If that individual is coming back, which is the case, 95 to 97% of everyone who's incarcerated are coming back home. We need to make sure that that person has every tool necessary, every resource available, so that when he does come back home, he's going to be an asset, not a liability.
Dan, downtown, you're on the air with James Windham, the executive director of Capital Area Reentry Coalition.
Yes. Would you say that one of the problems for ex-cons is that employers today still discriminate on non-merit factors like race, sex, age, and disability?
Well, the challenge with that is I'm not going to accuse anyone of discriminating, but the point is if an individual has a record and he's sitting there in front of the employer with another guy who has no record, human nature says I'm less likely to hire someone that I know has had problems, even though the person who never has been arrested may have just as many problems. But human nature is such that we are tend to avoid any look of conflict. And so what we want to do is, by banning the box, it eliminates that possibility.
Well, James Windham, we thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tonight, 7 o'clock, LSU Journalism School. Thank you, sir.
And thanks again for having me on the show.
Appreciate it. 297-5633 is your number. John McMillan, Assistant Professor of History at Georgia State University, is our guest. He's the author of the critically acclaimed Smoking Typewriters, The 60s Underground Press, and The Rise of Alternative Media in America. His latest work is Beatles versus Stones. Good morning, Professor McMillan.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Well, you obviously have an affinity for both of these magnificent and iconic groups from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and zeros, and they're still going in their own way. Although two of the Beatles, of course, are no longer with us, and the Stones have had their tragedies as well. But why have they been so enduring?
The Beatles and the Stones. I think they're just the two most iconic and culturally influential bands to come out of the 60s. And, you know, certainly the Beatles took the world by storm, roughly 50 years ago. Around now, the Beatlemania started about 50 years ago, this month, more or less.
That's right.
And then the Stones have had this incredible staying power. They've been together. They've outlasted the Beatles by an astonishing 43 years, which is hard to fathom, really.
Did Mick Jagger and Keith Richards kind of look down on the Beatles?
Well, when they were first getting going in the early 60s, when the Beatles and the Stones met, the Beatles were already kind of a national sensation in England. They hadn't become, worldwide famous. But they, and so the Stones looked up to them in some respects, but also they may have looked down on them because the Beatles were from Liverpool. And Liverpool, of course, is in northern England. And a lot of people from London felt that northern England was kind of a culturally barren wasteland and that the people from that area were kind of, they were hicks or provincials. And the Stones thought of themselves as hip cosmopolitans early on. And so there was a bit of a cultural disconnect between the two groups when they were first getting to know each other. But they also admired each other's songwriting abilities and everything else.
Well, the Beatles made an amazing evolution over the 6 or 7 years they were on the world scene. Their music at the end sounded somewhat or maybe a lot different than it did at the beginning. For example, I doubt that Mick Jagger was a big fan of I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah, I think that the Stones were into the kind of gritty American blues, and I think they admired the Beatles' commercial success and were perhaps a bit jealous of that. But they did, I think, see the Beatles as kind of maybe a manufactured type of boy band that was just, being so commercially successful. But musically, they came from different perspectives in the early 60s.
When the Beatles had their famous concert, one of their most famous, at Shea Stadium, you say the Stones were there? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. They were special guests, and so they were able to watch the whole show from the opposing team's dugout. And, that Shea Stadium show is by far the largest rock concert and pop concert in history. There were 55,600 people. And the Stones were, very impressed with the response that the Beatles got. Of course, you've probably seen the images of that show where everyone is hysterical and screaming and, the fans are so overwrought with emotion. And that was a really impressive scene for everyone, and especially the Stones.
Were they screaming too?
I doubt they were screaming the way that the young girls were screaming for the Beatles, but they were impressed. They talked about being frightened by the scene, actually. It seemed like the whole stadium was on the verge of some kind of, pandemonium, and it was deafening and a little bit scary for a lot of people that were there to see people, so many people gathered, losing emotional control the way they did.
297-5633. We'll take a 90-second break and return with John McMillan. His book is Beatles versus Stones from Simon & Schuster. We'll be right back. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and just a bit CB for Godston, but we continue with John McMillan, professor at Georgia State University, and this history professor is a master when it comes to the history of music, and with the sophistication of a historian, the storytelling skills of a journalist, the passion of a fan. John McMillan is exploring the multifaceted relationship between the two greatest bands of our time. Beatles versus Stones is his book. Now, in our conversation before the break, you were commenting about the differences between the two, and of course there are many similarities, but here we have the Beatles, who were marketed as cute guys, amiable, friendly fellows. They came from hard scrabble backgrounds in Liverpool, and the Stones, edgy, dangerous, and they hailed from the London suburbs. Somebody did a pretty good job at marketing.
Both bands had some very savvy and clever managers. And so, as you said, the Beatles came from these sort of tough backgrounds and working-class backgrounds in Liverpool. John Lennon, in particular, was kind of a known troublemaker. And when they were first getting going, they were known for playing, loud rock and roll and wearing leather outfits and so on. But it was their manager, Brian Epstein, was the one who got them to, bow and conform and be polite. And once they sort of followed his, creative lead in terms of how they styled themselves, they had tremendous success. And then, as you mentioned, the Stones, at least the two of the leading members, Brian Jones and Mick Jagger, were both upper middle class. They were very well educated. Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics, which was a very prestigious school. And this was at a time when only about 2% of British kids went on to college. And Brian Jones could have gone to a selective school if he'd wanted to. He tested very well in his prestigious grammar school. But under the influence of their manager, Andrew Oldham, they began to market themselves as being a little surly and defiant, and they began to attract a following among sort of disaffected young people in England at the time.
Now, they were great performers, and some of them still are, before the masses, but in the studios, both groups were fantastic, weren't they?
Yeah, they sure were, although the Beatles were kind of pioneering in the sense that, they began to move in a new creative direction, and they would kind of demonstrate for their producer, George Martin, what they wanted to do, and they were more creatively daring and innovative maybe than any other band. But then the Stones kind of followed that lead. When the Stones were first getting going, they wanted to record records that kind of sounded like what they were doing in the clubs. They wanted to get the kind of, raunchy blues sound on their records. But then the Stones became a little more sophisticated and polished in the way they recorded as well, I think under the Beatles' influence.
Well, the Beatles gave a memorable concert September 16, 1964. Next year will be 50 years, City Park in New Orleans. And who would have thought that 50 years later that McCartney would still be going pretty strong? And the Stones, who aren't that much younger than the Beatles, they're still doing it. Who would have thought this would be?
Nobody would have thought, because there was no precedence for that. Obviously, what happened was these groups like the Beatles were thought to be. Everyone thought they were going to be just a fad, and that they would get a little bit older, and they would outgrow their fans, and they would sort of move on. And there wasn't any precedent for a group evolving artistically and maturing the way the Beatles did and the Stones. And, going on to play, rock and roll at an older age, no one had done that before.
What are your favorite works of the two?
Oh, I guess I'm a big fan of the Beatles in the sort of mid-60s, from Rubber Soul to Sgt. Pepper, so like 65 to 67. I love all those records. And then the Stones, I think, had their best period in the late 60s and early 70s, like from Beggar's Banquet to Exile on Main Street, from about 68 to 72. Those were the best periods in my opinion. In the book, I don't write a lot about my aesthetic judgments. It's more of a history of how the rivalry was constructed by fans and by the groups themselves and by people in the media. But I do love both groups, and especially those periods.
Well, thank you, John McMillan. The book is Beatles versus Stones.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Our pleasure. That's an appropriate segue to CB for Godston. Did the Stones get equal time, Kevin? 297-5633 is your number. That song, by the way, was named the greatest song of the rock era by Rolling Stone magazine, 1965. You're old enough to remember 1965, aren't you, C.B. Forgotston?
Very much so. In fact, that brings back a lot of memories of my college days.
Well, John McKithen was governor.
Yep.
Lyndon Johnson was president. And the world was a different kind of place in 1965. And today is 48 years later, and C.B. Forgotston, we've got a few things to comment with you about that are of recent vintage, including Saturday, last Saturday, in a race that energized the electorate so much in the 5th District that 19% of the voters came out to vote. And the final tally was 60% for a guy named Vance McAllister, who owns several Subway franchises, and Neil Reiser, an incumbent state lawmaker supported by the Republican establishment, came in with 40% of the votes, 36,000 votes in a district with about 500,000 registered voters. That's 7.2% of the registered voters voted for an incumbent senator seeking a congressional seat who supposedly had the road paved for success. What in the world happened?
Well, what happened was the public who did bother to go vote decided to send a message. And I think it was less about Vance McAllister and more about the dirty deal that the Team Jindal had put together to pave the way for Reiser. And frankly, when it first came down, well, when Representative then Congressman Rodney Alexander suddenly resigned after telling his staff that he would be there through the end of the term, I thought that they had probably pulled it off, but I didn't count on the anger being enough where 13 other individuals would jump into the race, and one political novice who was willing to put his money where his mouth was, and that is Vance McAllister, hopped in and gave people an alternative to Reiser. Now, I'm not taking anything away from McAllister. I hope he becomes a great congressman, and frankly, I believe when he goes to Washington, he'll pretty much vote right down the Republican line. And he's got a lot of homework to do because he faces re-election in another year, in November of 2014. But it was a backlash against Bobby Jindal and dirty, rotten politics in Louisiana, in my opinion.
Well,
Jindal claims he didn't endorse him, didn't endorse Reiser, but he did. You know, he talked about him, talked about what a good friend he was and everything. And, you know, that is insulting to our intelligence to say that that wasn't an endorsement.
You call it the Neil deal. Well,
yes.
Vance McAllister goes to Washington today, I think, and he's never been there before, not even as a tourist. Now he's a member of Congress. This is a great Louisiana story, but it wasn't like 70% of the people voted, as about that many voted in Port Allen to recall a mayor there last week. But here we have this very low turnout, 19%. And to show you what's happened, 11 years ago in the same district, Rodney Alexander won against Lee Fletcher, and almost 200,000 votes were cast. This time around, CB, 91,000 votes cast in this race. That's abysmal.
And that's, I blame that on the Neil deal and Bobby Jindal and Timmy Teeple, who put together the Neil deal, and Rodney Alexander and Neil Reiser, who did this. I mean, we've got enough problems with elections in this state, and that's subject of a whole nother show. But to waste $2.7 million of taxpayers' money to have a special election in a congressional district that geographically spans half the state is just absolutely atrocious. I mean, that just shouldn't happen. And that's the cost. And the turnout was just as they had planned it to be. They wanted a low turnout. And when you have politicians like Bobby Jindal wanting low turnout, doesn't want the full participation, and that's what he set out to do.
Well, there have been candidates who spent almost no money in congressional races, like Steve Myers in 1996 against Richard Baker, who got about as many votes as Neil Reiser did this past Saturday. So whatever the Reiser campaign strategy was, it sure didn't work. And you're blaming it on this noise in the background. Could the candidate have been a problem, too?
The candidate was a problem, and it was surprising to me because I don't know Reiser. He's been in the Senate for 6 years, and I've tried to reach him over that time, and he's never responded to me. I've never met him. But when I did see him on TV interviews and watched the debate on LPB, it was embarrassing to see somebody that had actually been in the state legislature for 6 years that was so inarticulate, so uneasy, and unable to put together a thought or have any talking points except he had to read them. I mean, and the contrast between he and McAllister was just phenomenal. McAllister was at ease. He answered the questions. Granted, he was inarticulate at times and might have said some things. Well, he said exactly what he was thinking from the heart. That's dangerous when you're in politics. That's why I probably would never get elected to anything, because somebody asked me a question just like you do. I'm going to say what's on my mind. I'm not going to think about whether that's going to make me popular or not. And that's exactly what he did. And probably his worst problem was just not to fully explain what he said. I mean, not used to being a politician, he didn't talk enough in some cases. But nevertheless, I really, and people thought I was crazy, but right after the primary, I said that it was McAllister's to lose.
Well,
everybody
I think you're crazy. You were on this show. I think you said it was all over.
Yeah. Because the backlash was there, and there was nothing they can do to stop it. I mean, they threw the Reiser campaign, the state Republican Party, and all its mechanism threw everything they had at Reiser, at McAllister, including some things that didn't even exist, and didn't make a dent. It was 60-40 from when the primary was over, and it was 60-40 when the election ended a month later.
297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. We'll talk about this for a few more minutes. Vance McAllister outpointing Neil Reiser as the Duck Dynasty crowd gets the nod over the Jindal political machine. What does that say about reality TV, CB? Some are saying that that's what pushed McAllister over the.
Well, you can't say reality TV in general, because I don't think an endorsement from the governor's wife would have done the same thing. It crashed. What it says is that people relate to Duck Dynasty, and frankly, I don't watch it. People have told me, I need to watch it. It's funny. I said, I don't need to watch it. I grew up with those folks, not those in particular, but those are the kind of people I grew up with. So, you know, nothing new to me. They're funny, and they speak from the heart, and that made a huge difference. It was not the reality TV show as much as who these people have come to represent, and they just seem like good-hearted, you know, natural people, and that's what the public was. They were looking for. I don't know that. Again, I don't know if anything changed the outcome of the election because the public, those 20% or 19% that went and voted, were so mad from the get-go that I don't know that all the advertising had much to do with it. I think that the Duck Dynasty folks, I thought that the initial ad by Phil, the matriarch of the, the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty family, made a huge difference in getting McAllister into the runoff.
297-5633, the bombastic blogger, C.B. Forgonston. That's forgonston.com, and he's with us to talk about state politics. Stephen, Central Highlands. Stephen, you're on with C.B. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, good morning, Jim. I wanted to say I have a little different take on this about the so-called anger that your guest is talking about. I'd ask the guest to comment on the participation in the election by the mayors from Monroe and Alexandria, and also the desire of people in that area to get the Medicaid expansion, really to get health care.
All right. McAllister, by the way, came out in favor of the Medicaid expansion, and he had support of candidates who were also in the race with him in the primary. Did that make a difference at all?
I think it made a difference a little bit in the turnout, but I think the fact that Bobby Jindal was backing Reiser, regardless of what Bobby Jindal said, I think the Democratic votes, and I think that's what Stephen is mostly talking about, and he did get the lion's share. In fact, I had predicted 95 out of 100 Democrats who went out to vote would probably vote for McAllister, but I think it was something like 80-something percent. So I really think that, yes, that might have been in some people's mind, but frankly, they didn't have anybody else to vote for. I mean, look at the black vote particularly. The black vote usually goes about 95% against Republicans, yet McAllister, I think, got 86% of the black vote. That's unheard of. But, again, you know, I don't want to take anything away from McAllister's campaign, but I just think the people between what was going on at the time in Washington with the shutdown and all that, they just said, we don't like the status quo. We'll try anything. And we don't want Bobby Jindal's boy up there because he's part of the status quo. And all he was talking about was the status quo. So there was just that differential between the two people. I don't think issues played any part. If they had, then the attack ads, that's all the Reiser campaign ran in the runoff was attack ads, would have had more of an impact. But they didn't. They had none.
297-5633. We'll be back and return to the phone lines with C.B. Forgonston, former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee, a lawyer who is now based in Tangipahoa Parish after being blown out by Katrina, with some thoughts about contemporary Louisiana politics. Vance McAllister goes to Washington for the first time as a U.S. House member. 297-5633, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757, wherever you are, or EngsterShow@WRKF.org for C.B. Forgonston. Analyst superb about Louisiana politics, Dominic in Grand Coteau. Hi, Dominic. You're on with C.B.
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. C.B., you know, your comment there about the, even with the attack ads that Ryzen lost, I mean, could that be a sign that people are starting to pay more attention, that realize that the, you know, the key word there, attack, that these attacks by these people aren't working anymore, and they're just smelling the coffee and are starting to maybe vote for their better interests?
Well, I wish that was true, I hope it is, but I don't believe it. I believe that attack ads didn't work in this case because, first of all, Reiser had Bobby Jindal hanging around his neck, and that was just the killer from the get-go. But I also believe the dynamics were different in this race, and I believe attack ads still work. I mean, historically they do, and I never bet against history in Louisiana. But here's wishing that they stop working.
297-5633 is your number. Governor Jindal, who has seen his poll numbers plummet, is now getting some pushback from fellow Republicans, and one of those was on this show last Friday, and Ben Baggert, the former state senator, who remains a ranking member of the Republican Party with the Jefferson Parish Executive Committee, prominent New Orleans lawyer, over a quarter century in the Louisiana legislature. Here was Ben Baggert last Friday on this show.
I'm a Republican. I'm ashamed of Governor Jindal. I'm a conservative. I don't care what else Governor Jindal does. If he puts Louisiana second on this issue, he's forfeited his right to lead the country. He's forfeited his right to continue serving as our governor, and he should just get out of the way.
Now, that's Ben Baggert calling for Jindal's resignation, and he was serious about it, CB, over this John Berry removal from the levy board down in South Louisiana. When Ben Baggert, a Republican, starts piling on the governor, I would think there's some shoring up to do in the ranks. Or is it too late, in your judgment?
It's too late. Bobby Jindal is finished. This election proved that beyond any shadow of a doubt. He's finished nationally. I talk to people like you do in Washington periodically, and nobody takes him serious. Yes, he does go around and make talks. He's a draw for fundraisers, just like Arnold Schwarzenegger would be. I don't understand celebrity, frankly, but people will pay money to go see a celebrity. Jindal has a type of celebrity status because he's unique in that he is he's Indian by ancestry, and so the people, and they find something about the way he talks appealing. I don't. I mean, he talks so fast, he makes no sense. But some people think that means that they're just not intelligent enough to understand it, and they want to go hear this super smart person who portrays this myth of the Louisiana miracle. So Bobby Jindal has been finished. As far as shoring up, he's got no shoring up to do. It would have meant more to me, and I don't disagree with anything that Benny said, but I think it would have meant more to me if a sitting member of the state legislature had said that, because I'm not seeing that. The legislators are still cowered by Jindal. They still do everything he asks. He still gets his vote in the legislature, and so I want to see change, but these legislators, as long as they believe that the sole reason for being reelected will be bringing home the bacon, Jindal will be able to control.
Okay, well, you may have just contradicted yourself, CB. On one hand, you said he's finished, and on the other hand, you say he controls the legislature.
Well, I'm talking about politically. I'm sorry if I gave that impression. No. He's not been diminished at all when it comes to power in Louisiana and inside of government. But with the, I thought we were talking about the public.
Right.
With the public, he's finished, state and national.
Well, when you think about the governors we've had, there have been some who've been reelected, such as Bobby Jindal. But usually, after governors are elected a second time, by Mike Foster being an example, John McKithen being an example, it's over for them. They don't win another election. Buddy Romer never won another election after being elected the first time. Kathleen Blanco never won another election. She never ran for again, but it was over for her after one term. So being governor is not necessarily a catalyst for future political endeavors.
Well, Bobby Jindal had a great opportunity. He came in with an overwhelming mandate. He got elected the first time in the primary, which is unheard of in an open seat. Came in with a blank check. He could have done a lot of things to turn Louisiana around. But when he came into office, we were last in everything that was good, first in everything that's bad. And we remain so today, despite the press releases from him and Stephen Morey. So he had a chance to catapult himself into the presidency. All he had to do was stay in Louisiana and do his job and do it using the mandate he had.
All right. Kevin Gallagher points out David Treen also, one term and gone, never won another election after being elected governor of Louisiana in 1979. Today, the Baton Rouge Advocate takes aim at Treasurer John Kennedy for going after these NGOs to save about $2 million. You find fault with the Advocate. Why so?
Well, because that was the look, I'm supposed to be a world-class cynic, and that's made me blush. I mean, that was too cynical for me. They're saying, oh, it's a waste of time. The money's already been spent. Well, that's naive and a lack of understanding of the law, as well as just saying, well, it's all just a publicity stunt. Look, there's a lot of great things in America have happened because somebody was trying to either make money for himself, like a Bill Gates, and the public benefited from it. And the same thing with Kennedy. So he gets publicity. So that helps his image. But he's trying to do the right thing. I've been writing about these NGOs for years. They got virtually no attention. Yeah, we talked about them on your show a few times, but the public never really got riled up. When Kennedy went after him, he's the first statewide elected public official to really go after these NGOs and this wasteful spending, especially when we have needs in healthcare and higher education. Suddenly the public got behind him and they got riled up and they put enormous pressure on the legislators. And the Advocate's attitude is, it's not worth going after, the money spent. Well, the IRS, the reason they are such a big bear and why we basically voluntarily pay our income taxes is we're scared to death of them because we know that they will spend $1 million to collect $10.
Okay.
And that is the only way that people are going to start paying attention if they think we're serious about the existing laws. I mean, it would be the equivalent of Les Miles telling the Tiger football team this week, look, we can't beat Johnny Manziel. I mean, let's just go out there and, you know, we'll suit up, but look, I ain't going to put any pressure on him because we can't beat him, so just go out there and try not to get hurt too bad. I mean, it set me off when I read that.
Well, okay, you make a good point. And Treasurer Kennedy, I think most of the time is sincere. Maybe all of the time he's sincere. But here's one where you may differ with your good friend John Neely Kennedy. He was on this show a few weeks ago, and he said that building this $2 million center for Mike Foster's papers in Franklin is a great idea. Come on, he's going after $2 million on these NGOs, and he thinks $2 million for a Franklin museum or library, whatever you want to call it, in Franklin's a good idea.
Well, that's extremely disappointing because that makes no sense. We've got archive buildings that the taxpayers have already funded. This was nothing but a deal to help renovate the city hall for the town of Franklin because Mike Foster had the clout to do it, and it was done under the guise of some archives for his papers. What papers does he have? His law school final exams? I mean, seriously, maybe, you know, what great works did he do? Who wants to go see him? But I didn't know about Kennedy saying that's just horrible.
Well, he did say that. In fact, he said other governors should have the same opportunity. So.
Well, I'm all for it, but Mike Foster's a multi-millionaire, a center millionaire. He has hundreds of millions. He can write a check for $2 million without even transferring any money into his checking account.
Well, he didn't take any money when he was governor, did he?
Oh, yes, he did. He put it. He took it after a fashion. But he put it in a trust fund type thing, which he doled out so he could get not only his retirement benefits, but a huge tax break because he made millions every year. So by a donation was worth as much or more to a wealthy person like Mike Foster as the actual cash. But what the real benefit to him was that enhanced his state retirement. A lot of people forgot that he was in the state pension fund. He's one of the reasons we have an unfunded accrued liability. Not only did he use all of his state time, but he bought in his time when he was on as just a non-paid volunteer member of the St. Mary Parish Harbor and Terminal Commission. I mean, he milked the system for everything it was worth.
Well, I would hope that Treasurer Kennedy might have a change of heart on this. And it's tough, as you know, when somebody is a political ally and a good friend and they want something done, quite often you listen more intently to them than you would a political enemy, right?
Of course. I mean, as Edwin Edwards said, what do? Expect me to reward my enemies? You know, who you gonna help? Your friends.
What was it Edwards said? There are four people who are vying for contracts or positions, and they're qualified friends, unqualified friends, qualified enemies, and unqualified enemies. I'll go with number one.
Right. At least he was honest about it.
Mark in Lafayette. Hi, Mark. You're on with CB.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
All right.
Going back to the McAllister race, when some of my friends, because I'm being located in Lafayette in South Louisiana, were kind of disconnected from the emotions of North Louisiana. With all things being considered, when we look back at what has happened here and what we're moving forward with the future, was that race against a Tea Party endorsed candidate versus a conservative, or was it a conservative versus conservative? When you have a national pundit look at this, was the choice between right and right, or ultra right and right, or Tea Party and right? And let me give you one more thing so you can answer all this in one thing. And when we look at this guy, we look at McAllister as being a future rep, what are we really ending up with? What kind of are we looking up with a Tea Party person or not? And then are we ending up with a real leader that's going to be a leader among leaders?
All right.
Let me give you a very frank answer, and you'll find it all in writing on my website, forgotston.com, where I outline the whole thing today. Both were Tea Party candidates. The media, unfortunately, misunderstood what the Tea Party of Louisiana is. That's a Baton Rouge group that endorsed Reiser. What was not mentioned was that the local chapters, and I was confused. I thought that the Tea Party of Louisiana was some kind of umbrella organization. It's not. It's just a nice name for a chapter of the Tea Party. The Tea Party groups, individual chapters, all act independently, and those that are in the 5th District, I can't name exactly all of them, but they, in fact, endorsed McAllister. And the reason I was confused about it is I was listening to talk radio, and Tea Party members in the district, in the 5th District, Baton Rouge is not in it, were calling in saying, Neil Reiser won't even come to our forums, and McAllister comes to our forums. So that's the bottom line is they're both Tea Party candidates.
Here's a comment from Stephen Dixon. He says, I think CB and I are not disagreeing too much about the congressional race. The reason why the mayors in Shreveport and Alexandria got behind the anti-Jindal guy was because of Jindal's opposition to Medicaid expansion and the new guy's openness to Medicaid expansion. If you don't believe that, ask these mayors. That's the take from Stephen, that Medicaid was...
Well, it was Monroe, not Shreveport. Shreveport's not in the district. Monroe and Alexandria. I don't know. I've not heard anything from either one of those mayors.
Well, Vance McAllister goes to Washington. We're down to 6 congressmen, and some people are making seniority an issue and hoping that it will help Mary Landrieu next year. But what a difference we have, CB, now and a generation ago as far as seniority on Capitol Hill. We've got a bunch of newbies, and we've got Landrieu, who hasn't been there that long herself. You know, in the old days, 18 years wasn't a long time.
Exactly. No, and it's very concerning because we're going to keep the seniority system in Washington, and that's just the facts of life. That's not going to change. We're not going to have term limits. And it concerns me. But what really concerns me is not that they're quitting not that they're retiring or something like that. What bothers me are people like Richard Baker and Jim McCreary and Billy Tozan, who go up there, get elected, and then they get reelected based on the fact that they're gathering seniority. About the time they reach the pinnacle of seniority, they quit to become a lobbyist at $1 million.
And John Breaux did the same thing.
Exactly.
We thank you, CB. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim.
Good talking with you. Let's do it again soon. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.